The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 161 for Monday, July 28th, 2008.
Greetings, folks. I'm Dave Hamilton. That was John Braun, and you are listening to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. How are you tonight, John?
Fantastic.
Excellent. I've said it before, and we've gone down the path, but every time you say fantastic, of course, I think of Lantastic, but we're not going to go down that path again.
No.
But we do have a lot to go down. We do have lots of different paths to go down tonight. We're going to learn about the Mac OS X spelling checker a little bit. Talked about some cache sizes. We've got more haikus to wrap that up for Smile on My Mac's fifth birthday, where they're giving away 5 licenses to their apps, the app of their choice for all of the winners, app of the winner's choice for the winners of the haiku contest. And some stuff about password security, tips, cool stuff found, all kinds of great stuff. But, you know... Again tonight, John, we're getting ready to prep the show. I sit down, I look in Yojimbo because that's where I keep all of the stuff for the show, and it's organized, you know, it's great. I do it on my machine down in the office. I come up here to the studio and magically it's here. No, it's not here. You know, the last time Yojimbo synced, I can tell, is not today, sometime earlier than today. Yeah. And you know, I look and on this machine... The little, you know, dot Mac sync thing, mobile me, whatever it is. It's the same stuff, same junk, different day, different name. You know, they got the little mobile me icon, sync icon in the menu taskbar thing there. I click on that and it says that the last time it synced was today, and that's fine. You know, I go downstairs, I look at that computer. Last time it synced was yesterday. You think maybe if it was having trouble syncing, it might want to alert me. So here's the thing. I tell it to synchronize manually. And then it comes up with an error message. Can't sync because, you know, this one thing isn't right. Mail rules or some happy hoo-ha or whatever. It's like, okay, well, let's fix that, shall we? And by the way, next time something happens, why don't you just come on and tell me instead of sitting back there, not showing any error message, nothing. What in what world is that the right way to write software? You write software for a living.
In Apple's world, Dave, because you see, obviously this has you very upset and...
Yes.
You see, by showing you the error message, they're going to get you upset. You'll think that something's going wrong. So they just kind of hide the harsh reality of the error from you unless you really, really want to dig and get at the info. So I totally understand their strategy. They're protecting you from trauma.
Yeah, except, you know, maybe if I'm relying on the sync to have actually worked because nothing said otherwise and I've been sitting at the stupid computer all freaking day... You think maybe? Oh, and another thing, by the way, if you've got some sync conflict to fix, don't bury that behind every living window on my Mac so that there's no way I'll ever know that I need to do that unless I notice, oh, it hasn't synced in a day. Let me dig through a couple of windows here and, oh, look at that. It needs my attention. You think there'd be a better way? I mean, my God, what the heck?
I'm with you because, yes, I do software and at least the software that I've been involved with, a lot of the, and I would say in some cases, the majority of the development effort is to catch all of your errors and report them properly.
Properly. One word. And it,
or report them at all. Now, what you're describing to me makes absolutely no sense because if it's available via one mechanism, which to me, the only difference between the mechanisms is one, you manually press a button, the other one, it kind of wakes up and does its thing. They should behave in the exact same way. Now, maybe, I don't know, if somebody made a decision that, you know, if it's on automatic, then maybe you don't want to toss up a dialogue that disrupts things.
Okay, but I have an idea.
In my opinion, that's a, let the user.
Ooh, me.
Let the user determine whether they do that.
Or, you know, because I just happen to have the time capsule, the time machine icon right next to the mobile me sync icon, and when there's a problem backing up, it puts a little exclamation point in the middle of the icon. Doesn't disrupt your workflow, doesn't do anything.
It's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's the way you should do it.
Maybe those guys could have lunch, and if they don't mind, they could share the code that draws the pixels for the exclamation point and the dudes in Mobile Me, and by dudes I mean anybody that works there regardless of sex, could implement that, because I don't care if it's a sexless trained monkey that puts it in there, but something. Please, something. It could be an amoeba, right? As long as it puts that code in there for the next release of macOS 10. That's all I'm looking for. That's it.
Yes, now I believe the feminine of dude is dudette.
I think it's just dudes. Cause, you
well,
know,
that's the plural, all-inclusive. But if you're identifying a single female dude, I think it's a dudette.
All right. Well, see, I grew up here in New England, and everybody is you guys, right? That's just how it goes.
So, oh, well, where I was, you know, which a little, you know, kind of southern part of Canada.
You and I grew up in the same spot.
We said y'all.
No, you didn't. All right.
No, we didn't.
Maybe.
All right,
Stuart.
Boy, that was a good tangent, but that was a good rant. So I'm with you. Somebody either it's a bug or somebody made a bad decision as to how it should react.
Mobile Me is the result of many bad decisions gone unchecked. It a great idea, and as I've said many times before, when it works, which is the majority of the time. Now, I'm not saying this is acceptable.
Oh, sure.
I love it. Oh, it's awesome. And dude, with the iPhone and the iPhone being a Mobile Me client, and you know, I went to the dentist today, and you know, they told me about a new appointment, right? So, you know, I put the thing into the calendar. By the time I got back to my desk, it's there. Good to go. That's beautiful.
Very
dude.
Nice.
Yeah. All right. So
very nice. And you know, all right. So you're on a tangent or a rant, and I'm just going to wrap it up because I've tried something new, which I really like. I think I told you we were migrating to Entourage.
Yeah. Yeah.
I got to say, I never thought I'd say this, but they did a really, really good job.
You're using Entourage or Outlook?
Entourage.
Okay.
On the Mac side.
On the Mac side.
So,
of course.
So
right.
At the 9 to 5, they're rolling out
Exchange server.
They're ditching Notes and they're putting up Exchange. So the Mac people, of course, run Entourage. You got to run the latest version in the latest office. And so I'm testing on both platforms just for kicks because we have a pretty good Mac community. Not huge, but they permit it. It's not as bad as it used to be. But I was just thrilled at how it runs. And I mean, the coolest thing to me is that I'm running it on, you know, my portable, and I only have it set up to talk to the work server. You don't have to run the VPN. It does a secure tunnel. They architected very nicely. So hats off to our IT people for doing it that way. Because before you had to VPN in, or you could use the web client, which was kind of icky. But here, it just kind of knows. There's a web client. If you have the you know, big boy client like Entourage or Outlook, it'll go through a secure tunnel. Very, very well done. So I you know, in the past, I never thought I'd say this, but they did it. I don't know if you've used Entourage at all, but...
Now, yeah, I have, but not to talk to an Exchange server. Now, does Entourage use its own tunnel, or does it use OWA, which is Outlook Web Access? I for some reason, I thought at one point in time, Entourage used OWA to get its data back and forth, which is fine. I mean, it's a known quantity. There's no reason not to use it.
As far as I know, from whatever call from the dialog box, it's actually a web DAB, a 443 connection.
Yeah. Okay.
So to me, it's not really important. So it's a secure tunnel.
It is.
Like a browser.
Right.
But
it's not talking to the Exchange server like Outlook would talk to it, I don't think.
It's a gateway.
Yeah. I think it's using the OWA gateway to do its magic, which is fine.
The end result is that it works just as if I was sitting at my desk.
That's
so
beautiful.
And it's secure because they're using SSL and all that.
All right. So while we're on the rant thing here, I'm going to take this. So we've heard that the iPhone supports Exchange, and I'm sure it's true if you actually were ahead of the technology curve.
Oh, yes. And some of my coworkers, actually. So a few of them, some I was surprised because not all of them are big Apple fans, but they were able through the same gateway.
Yep.
To use their iPhone to connect to the Exchange server. So
right.
They're all thrilled that they can do it. And it just kind of worked. I think there's a certificate warning for some bizarre reason. I don't know.
But
other than that they were just kind of shocked that it just kind of worked. As I was running the you know, heavy client on the Mac. I'm
right.
Like, wow, it just kind of connected.
Okay. So here's the thing. When mail comes in now, there's this big discussion about push email, and I'm going to talk about that right now, but I'm also going to say, I obsessed over push email when I got my Trio 3 years ago. And that's actually the reason I stumbled onto the great email client that I always mention called Chatter. But But in reality, I think I used push email about four different times for specific reasons. And then otherwise, I had it check every hour. And that was plenty and saved my battery tons. And I'm
doing this. Are you talking IMAP?
Well, and that's where I'm going with this. So on the Trio, IMAP has an extension to the protocol. And it's not just on the Trio. But IMAP in and of itself has an extension called IDLE. And what that does is it allows you to create a connection to the IMAP server. It allows your Mac will do it with Leopard. The mail client does it. And then there's various mail clients on portable devices that'll do it. And you log into the server and then say, okay, I'm done, but I don't want to disconnect. I want to leave the connection idle. And then what happens is other than some periodic kind of handshakes, the connection is dormant. There's no data passed until the server gets a new message in your inbox, at which point the server says to the client, hey, you might want to check for mail. And then the client goes and checks for mail, and sure enough, the message comes in. So it approximates that whole idea of push email in that as soon as the message is on the server, bam, it's on your desktop. Now, on the iPhone, we know that we can do this quote-unquote push email with MobileMe, and that works fine. And we also know that bypassing Apple's servers entirely, you can do the same thing with Exchange, like your coworkers do there, John. The Exchange server syncs up, and then the Exchange does it with its own protocol, but it's the same thing. The server says there's new mail, and boom, you know, you've got it right away. You don't have to wait for a periodic check. What is amazing to me is they bothered to implement all of this stuff, including the support for Exchange, which totally, again, bypasses MobileMe servers. And yet they do not support IMAP idle on the iPhone. So if you've got some third party IMAP mail server, i.e. anything but MobileMe or an Exchange server, you can't do push email. And again, for me, I don't really care because it doesn't matter. I don't use push email. I don't see the particular obsession does not apply to my OCD.
Well, that's the whole BlackBerry crowd, right?
It is. Yeah, exactly.
Crackberry, as we put it.
Yeah. But I don't understand why they don't support idle on the iPhone when they support all this other stuff. But anyway, that's my little rant there. But
wow. Okay. So yeah. We should probably get to the show, but that was a good rant. And please, you know, if you have any follow-ups or, you know, opinions about what we ranted about, good or bad, you know, let us know.
Stuart writes in, "Hi, Dave and John. I regard myself as a Mac tech head, but this has me puzzled. I got a friend to buy a G5 iMac some years ago, 1.8 gigahertz model. As far as I know, they were still using Tiger 10.4. They have a teenage son who gets past the passwords and into the admin account. I set the iMac up that when the iMac starts up, it will go straight into the account login screen. I would put a password in that only the parents know. They say they've changed the password a number of times and say he doesn't see what they type to know the password, but he's still able to access the accounts and change his account using the parent account. How is this possible? And is there a way for someone to bypass the login screen and get access to the main account?" All right. So my gut here says, well, to answer Stuart's question directly, yes, there is a way. If you have the boot up CD, a 10.4 startup CD, or maybe even a 10.3 or a 10.5, boot from the CD, it launches the installer, DVD, it launches the installer, you go to the install menu, or installer menu, or utilities menu, I guess, in later versions of the OS, and there's a reset password utility. So, yes, this is what happens. I'm sure he goes in, he resets the password, and boom, he's, you know, off and running. That would be my guess as to how this happens. So, my advice would be, you know, hide that CD. Right. What do you think, John?
Yeah, but you can get. Well, what do I? Oh, here we go. Okay. So to me, this is not just a technology issue. This is a parenting issue. Now, my initial reaction. So teenager, right? Somebody needs a whooping, I think. Oh wait, no. The belt. No. No, we certainly do not recommend. You know, beating your kid up for being a wise ass, but. Sorry. Here's the thing. You can now, depending on who listens to this, we're going to have a technology showdown here. There is a way to prevent the whippersnapper from booting off of the CD. And it depends. And actually, I looked in the past and Apple had updated their document on this, and we will link to it. But there is something called Open Firmware Password or Firmware Password Utility. What this does is that on almost every modern Mac, if you enable this, which could either be, and there are different ways to do it depending on what version of the OS you're talking, it may be on your hard drive, it may be on the boot disk. So this is why we're talking a race here to see who can figure this out first. Hopefully it's the parents. Is that you can run this, and basically if you enable this password, many functions of the computer are disabled, mostly for, I would say, security reasons, Dave. For example, one thing it disables is the ability to boot off of a CD, unless you know the password, the firmware password, as opposed to the admin password, just to be very clear. So this is different password that's kind of buried in the computer. So if you can get to this and enable this, our young friend will no longer be able to boot off of a CD, which, as far as I know, is how he's going about this. And it won't let you do a lot of other things too, Dave. And you and I looked over this list here. You know, you can't change the PRAM. You can't boot up in a lot of modes here, like netboot, target disk mode, things like that. All the little sneaky ways that you can, you know, kind of make the get at the information on the Mac without having to enter a password.
Excellent.
So now they do claim, you know, this is unsupported, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, use it at your own risk, I guess. But this is the way. Now, to go back and forth, I mean, if our young friend has access to the computer, in theory, I guess he could rip the thing open, pull the hard drive. And the thing is, physical access is once physical access is compromised, you're kind of in a rough situation. Though I doubt he's going to go to the effort to actually, he or she, I think he, is going to go through the effort to actually crack the machine open.
Yeah, with the iMac,
pull the hard drive.
Yeah, it's tough getting that drive. That's a lot of work. I mean, not a ton of work, but it's not as simple as just popping open a tower and pulling the drive out. That's right. Yeah.
But to me, I would say, enabling this will for the time being one up. But then again, seriously, this sounds like a trust and parenting issue, and I'm certainly no expert because I don't have kids. You do, Dave. But for things to get to that point where there's a suspicion that, you know, he's intentionally going against your wishes, that just doesn't sound good to me.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any fatherly advice there.
Actually, I'm going to dispense with my fatherly advice and just say, listen, look, you know, that kid, that's John and I a number of years ago, maybe just like two or three. But I know that as teenagers, you and I figured out all that stuff that we weren't supposed to figure out. Now, you know, our parents had no idea. They didn't really use the computers that we used much. So there was no issue with that. But that whole idea of, okay, here's this wall. Let me figure out how to get around it. That's pretty much all you and I ever did with our computers as kids. And it teaches you a lot about the troubleshooting process and all that. Now, yes, I'll pull my fatherly advice back in. Clearly, there's a trust issue in the household, and that's a bad thing. But fixing the trust issue while still allowing the child the ability to explore and learn these skills can obviously be very valuable. I mean, you know, John and I have taken pretty much that groundwork and individually each turned it into different things, but successful things. So, you know, I'm not going to ramble too much more here, but
yeah,
don't thwart the creativity here.
On the other hand, I think my parents, that they had some awareness of what I was doing. Mm-hmm. They played dumb when the phone cops came.
And, whoa.
But, oh no, the guy was like, wow, your son has very good technique, you know, navigating the phone system and not paying for making calls. And they kind of knew.
Right.
But, there's another, you know, regular dialogue, I think, you know, just, you know, why do you feel a need to, you know, do this? And what are you looking at? I mean, I can probably guess, but hey, that's not a topic of this podcast.
That's right. I was just going to say, we're now way off track.
So we'll link to this, and I think that will solve the technical problem of changing the admin password. Which actually, you know, I had to do that at work. Now, I'll admit, sometimes it's good to do that on certain older Windows platforms. You can get a Magic CD and blank out the admin password. In this case, we had to because it was a machine that was administered by somebody who suddenly had to leave the company.
Yep.
So nobody knew the admin password, and it was either Yeah, tear the drive out of there. Well, this was an NTFS drive, so that would have been pretty rough. Or run the magic utility that wipes the, you know, maybe we'll link to that too for our Windows folks. But you know, sometimes there's a legitimate reason to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was, when I had the consulting business, I remember saving someone's bacon one day. They had fired some guy and were in exactly that situation. And I had the magic floppy with me that I put in, and it was like, boom, here we go. You know, mm-hmm. And they're like, that's it. I'm like, you're done. You're all set. I'm like, oh, thank you. All right, Lou.
Hi, John. Hi, Dave. This is Lou calling from Madison, Wisconsin. See, I have a unique problem. My father has an iMac and has had the ability to probably every 2 months cause it to go to a blue screen of death or or just stop working to the point where my brother or I are summoned to restore everything. And I'm wondering, since he tells us he never, ever does anything to really make this happen, that it just does it on its own, but this is his second machine that it does it on its own, so I can't blame the hardware. What ways we can protect the machine so we can easily restore it? Thanks. Look forward to your answer. Bye.
Yeah, you bet, Lou. You know, so I heard this, and my first thought, John, was, all right, so accepting that you're going to have to go and rebuild this machine again, go ahead the next time you do it, bring a FireWire drive with you and make a super duper, you know, disk image of the whole drive as soon as you get it the way you want it before your dad gets to touch it. And at least that way, when you come back, you're able to, you know, just restore it quickly, easily. You don't have to reinstall apps. It's just boom, you wipe the drive, put the stuff back on, leave it in his overly capable hands, and off you go. And so that's my advice here. John, you have I know you've got some. how could you not have something to say about this?
So I'm gonna have a couple of things. So first off, I wouldn't necessarily assume, but well, let's cover the basics here. Machines can fail due to power spikes, due to all sorts of mishaps, maybe physical mishaps, or just could be bad luck. You and I, on occasion, Dave, have had bad luck. So I wouldn't necessarily, though I'm inclined to chalk it up, because my parents also, probably your parents too, every now and then they'll call with a computer question. Since they have Macs, it's usually not too often, but every now and then.
Oh, yeah.
But I would say, now I kind of chuckled as I started thinking about this, but then I started going down this path and I think it makes sense. So one, you may want to create a guest account on dad's machine.
You mean a non-admin
account? A non-administrator. I'm sorry, not Got guest. That's bad word. Because there is a guest account, I guess, right, which you're probably not supposed to use, actually. Or a lot of OSs, it's discouraged from having a guest account because it usually allows just anybody to stumble along and do certain things. So, but to create a non-administrator account, as you should know, or if you don't, an administrator can cause much damage to a system. And although Dave and I would say we're, you know, card-carrying geeks, we can run as administrator for the most part and not destroy things. For a non-technical user, I would say the best thing is to set up a non-admin account.
Right.
So to me, that's one option. Though I don't, you know, I haven't, to be honest, Dave, I haven't tried a non-admin account, but can non-administrators install apps, or would then the admin have to do that? I guess the admin would, right?
I think in most cases you've got to enter, even if you're logged in as an admin, you have to authenticate yourself in order for an app to be installed. So if you're not logged in as an admin, you then have to type the username and password, not just the password, of an administrator in order to do that.
So actually, you know, I'm thinking like an admin is that a lot of times, and I've seen this especially in the workplace, allowing non-technical people admin access and to install every little gizmo and gadget and the new generation of smileys and Bonsai Buddy and all.
I'm sure that's what's causing
these problems.
Horrible
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, in some cases, and I would argue there's a population that should not be given the ability to install apps. Yes, it's all about freedom and, you know, computers enable you and stuff, but sometimes you just got to put your foot down and say, look. So I would say in this case, you may want to actually also enable parental controls. Now, normally, parental controls is meant for, you know, parents to limit the actions of their kids. But I think in this case, it doesn't necessarily say which direction the parental relationship works. So wow. You may also want to further lock down the account by turning on parental controls for it. It not only, you know, disables certain things, but it also does some level of logging. So maybe you can, you know, after things crash and burn, you can dig through the wreckage and find in a log, if not the console logs, what exactly was done to cause grief. Like I have one friend who every now and then out of the blue when I start, you know, when he starts telling me, oh, well, you know, my Mac's not working right. And I'm like, okay, what did he do now? And like one was like, you know, I threw away my system folder. And now the system doesn't work. What do I do? I'm like, oh. So that's why I recommend either a non-admin or parental controls, because it'll clamp down a lot of, you know, the actions that can lead to disaster.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I know I laughed when you... it's because it's funny that it would be used backwards like that, but it makes perfect sense to me.
Yeah, because they have you know, simple finder, only allows selected applications. You can control to that level. Again, I haven't looked at this for a long time. I don't know if you use it with your kids, Dave, or you just kind of trust them.
We trust that we don't use it with our kids yet. Only because we haven't found a situation where we've had to. And
well, you have like a common area where
exactly.
The kids are surfing. Somebody is always there. So,
yeah.
so that I think is an excellent way to kind of manage things.
It is. And, you know, to be honest, that's how this is like the parenting show. But that's how it was when I was a kid. Our computer, the Apple IIc at the time, for those of you that listened to show 100, that was that my formative computing years were spent on that machine. But that Apple IIc was literally in the middle of our house. So, yeah, I mean, while my dad would be making dinner, or we'd be doing stuff, or family be watching TV or whatever, the computer was right there. So you could get away with a lot, but not, you know, you were always right there. So that's a good thing.
And I'm even chuckling here. They even have time limits.
Yeah.
So they have like weekday, weekend, and bedtime. So, you know, if you all also want to help your dad's overall health, I think you may want to enable the bedtime option to kind of enforce, you know, so he's not up at 3 a.m. on the computer. I mean, come on. Okay.
Okay.
But no, it's a facet of a parental controls that I never thought of before. So
there you go. There you go. Okay. Our first sponsor for this show is Audio Engine. AudioEngineUSA.com is where you go to check out all their products. Now, they've got a lot more products than they started with when they were first sponsors of the Geekab. You know, the first thing that we ever talked about here from them was the Audio Engine A5s, which are their, I'll call them full-size bookshelf speakers, if you will, full-range speaker. They're the ones that they sent me before it was even an official product, and I couldn't talk about the name, but I was able to talk about the product. And I still have that set of speakers right here on the desk in the studio. They're full range, lots of low end, two speakers, and then two speakers in each enclosure and two separate enclosures. And then hanging off the back, you can put an AirPort Express because it's got a little power jack, and it's got a USB port on the top that you can use to charge an iPod. And then, of course, you can plug the iPod in with the Mini 8 connector. Then they came out with the smaller version of those. So those are $349. The smaller version is the A2s, which have almost as full range of sound and in a much smaller enclosure. So truly desktop speakers. And those are $199. And then if you want, they have the AS8, which is their powered subwoofer, for $399, which you can put under the desk or wherever you like to really fill in that low end. And if you want these speakers, or really any speakers, to be remotely playable to from your Mac, and that's bad English, but good product. They have the AW1 for $149, which is a USB audio wireless adapter. And you plug one of them into your Mac, you plug the other end into any speakers. It can be powered via USB or a battery if the speakers don't have a USB port to power it. And using a Mini 8, you go right into the speaker. The coolest thing about it is, yes, it's wireless, but it's so, the latency is so low that you can totally play a movie on your Mac and have the sound come out of these wireless speakers and totally good to go. The cool part is 10% off to any Mac Geekgab listener using the coupon MGGTEN, all available at audioengineusa.com. And with that, we move on to John.
Well, you know, I got one other thing here. Yeah. For the prior question.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Time machine or time capsule would be a good thing.
Oh, yeah.
If at a certain point in time, all of a sudden things stop working. Well, from what I can see, you can roll back to an earlier time machine backup. So that may be a good
I guess you could. Yeah. I'd still do the carbon copy cloner or the super image just to have.
That would be the best backup option, but, you know.
Yeah, you might be able to trace back in time machine backups and see what your dad changed. That's a good idea for Lou. Excellent.
Mm-hmm. And the A5s, my test is I can crank them up to 11, go across the street, and I can still hear them, which
that's excellent.
A good test for any speaker.
Hey, isn't the police department across the street from you?
They're down the street.
Oh, all right. No, that's good.
they can't hear them.
Okay, good. that would be bad. Okay. So we've been talking about UPS's uninterruptible power supplies, that is, not little men and women in brown trucks and brown uniforms. Right. And John wrote in, not John Braun, but another John. And he says, just adding to your UPS discussion, I have my network switch, Airport Extreme, Skype phone, broadband router, all plugged in, aiming to maintain my internet and network connection. I have a 1500 volt amp APC branded UPS. I think this helps keep everything more stable, especially within the home network. I was, however, interested in your comment in episode 159 about only plugging directly from devices into the UPS. I don't do this. I've made up a few power strips to split the outlets to various devices. This is not only because there aren't enough outlets for my devices, but more importantly, the outlets are inappropriate for some devices. For example, my modem, external hard drives, etc., have transformer power bricks, i.e. wall warts, which don't connect directly to the sockets on the UPS. Also, the Macs I've owned in recent years have slightly modified power connectors. They have a wider bit around the plug that seems to make a more secure connection. The male-to-female cords supplied with the UPS don't make such a secure connection with Macs as the proper Apple power cables, so I have mine plugged into a normal socket in the power strip. I'm interested to hear this isn't supported by the warranty, but it hasn't caused me any problems in terms of the UPS not coping with the demand. While I have more devices than built-in outlets, many of the devices are low power. Okay. I learned this the hard way. I had a bunch of stuff blow up that was connected to a UPS. Now, in all fairness, none of the stuff blew up from AC power. It was actually DC power, i.e., Ethernet cable, coax cable, and telephone wires that took the surge and blew up various things in the devices. But I figured, hey, what the heck? I've got this UPS. It comes with a $25,000 hardware warranty for anything that's plugged into it. There's no limitation on whether it's connected to, you know, some low voltage thing elsewhere. Sounds good. So I called up whatever company it was. It wasn't APC, but from my understanding, they all support, they all act the same way in this regard. And I started explaining. They said, okay, yep, you know, got me to the warranty department. No problem. Fill out this form. And as part of the form, you need to diagram, you know, how you've got things plugged in. So, you know, start with the wall outlet and go from there. So, you know, wall outlet to UPS, UPS to power strips to devices, just like John describes in his letter. And they called me and they said, well, the only things we're supporting are the things that are plugged directly into the UPS. And I said, what do you mean? Like, well, we don't have a letter on file that we sent you that says that you're allowed to have a power strip. Do you have that letter? And I said, no. And they said, oh, yeah. Well, if you're going to plug anything into a power strip, if you're going to plug anything in between the device and the UPS, you need to call us first, tell us exactly what is going in between, and we need to send you a letter saying, yep, that's an approved way to set this up. So the way I had it set up may or may not have been approved, but being that it was all happening after the fact, they conveniently said, that's not approved. And you can't really blame them because they don't know what's in the middle. It's not their stuff. So they would have warrantied the power strip if that blew up, perhaps.
Oh, nice.
Right. But not anything beyond that. And in thinking about it, though, I wasn't really happy about their answer. You can't really blame them because they don't know what you've done here. And so for John and anyone else, I recommend either plug all the stuff directly in or give them a call. Tell them what you're doing. And chances are they'll send you a letter. I think it was Triplight, actually, was the manufacturer of the UPS that I had. Huh. And then you're good to go. And that way you're covered. But definitely call them and walk through that.
No, you know, I'll disagree with you. I think that's lame. I think if you're rated a certain, power amperage, wattage and all that, and somebody plugs in a power strip, which is basically an extension, I would say they should cover that too. What if the power strip
has a funky surge protector that's faulty, that sends a surge along the line that it shouldn't, or it causes some feedback loop or something, and then you're screwed.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't buy it. They should handle it.
Well, and maybe
if
they would.
There's a misbehaving device beyond the UPS, then deal with it,
Good luck.
You shouldn't permit, the bad thing to happen, which blows up everything connected to the power strip. You're the first line of defense. I don't know.
Well, that's how they work.
Now, again, I'm not a double E. I know double E's, so maybe there's a good technical reason why, but still, come on. What do you buy this stuff for? To prevent surges and all sorts of nasty things to happen. No, I'm with you, too. Yeah, if there's something weird, like if they create a short or something like that, who the heck knows? So,
right, and that's the thing. They don't know. It could be, think about this.
They really do it, because to me, it just sounds like bureaucratic red tape. Oh, yeah, you got to send us the model of, all this and that. Now, if they truly honored it, and that's why I guess I'm hesitant, because to me, it just sounds like a slight cop-out. Oh, well, you didn't fill out form ABC123-stroke,
right.
987.
Right.
Sorry, we can't honor your claim. And you remember us sending you that. It just, to me, hinted at, slightly, unwholesome behavior.
Unwholesome. Yeah, I think what it is, you're not supposed to plug another surge protector in. A dummy, like plain vanilla, does nothing but extend, but adds outlets, power strip, kind of a glorified extension cord. That's the kind of thing that they actually want you to plug into it. But if you plug
an extension cord.
Yeah.
So you would agree that an extension cord, which is just an electrical metal extension with no circuitry, that they should be able to deal with that.
As long as that extension cord is properly rated for the current that you're sending through it. And that too is the kind of thing that they want to, and they told me, they're like, look, we don't make a big deal about this. We do it all the time. We keep all these letters on file. But we got to know that you're plugging it into a cord that's doing this. And the guy said to me, what we need to make sure is you're not plugging another surge protector in, because that can cause a feedback loop, or even worse, plugging another battery backup unit into this one. And now we're trying to charge a battery, this whole stuff. He's like, look, he says, you, because I laughed when he said that, just like you did. He said, but people don't know. People think that,
if you can plug one thing into another, somebody's going to do it.
Bingo. Exactly. And he says, not all power strips are created equal. And I said, no, I got that. I said, I've built this in a way that it's right. He says, I believe you. He says, but corporate policy is that we can't cover anything that we haven't previously certified. And I said, okay, fair enough. So I bought more stuff. Not happy about it, but that's, yeah. So let that be a lesson to you. Whether you agree with it or not, if you want the stuff to be protected by that $25,000 insurance policy that most of those consumer grade ones pop on there, make sure you call them. Tell them what you're doing. Follow their advice. All right, is it time for Snoop, John?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Snoop writes in, right there. I have one question. On the Mac, we have system-wide spelling corrections, and that's really cool. But now I made a mistake. As I'm a non-native English speaker, I make some mistypes each time I write text, and then it's really cool to have the spelling checked directly. But on one word, I accidentally clicked on ignore. It is one word I mistype very often because of a similar word in my mother tongue. But the point is, I now want to change this ignore option again, but I cannot find it. I check system preferences and it's not there. It seems to be somewhere, but I don't know where. Please tell me where to access these system-wide spelling corrections. All right. This actually created quite a bit of research here at TMO Towers today.
And I think we're... I think I'll let you go. But we saw different behavior on different systems. At least I'm going to claim that, Dave. So...
Okay.
Huh?
You can claim that. So here's the thing. You've got... When you mistype a word, you have three choices. You can fix it. You can tell the system to ignore, and you can tell the system to learn. I'm going to guess that Snoop clicked learn at some point, because here's how they work. Oh, okay. Here's how they're supposed to work. When you click fix, obviously, it fixes it to whatever word you've chosen. If you click ignore, it ignores it only for that particular document, the whole document, but just that document and that session. When you open a new document or open that one again, it will re-complain about that particular word or that particular spelling. If you click learn, however, it learns it system-wide, and there is no GUI interface for editing that list once you've added something to it. You can't even see what's in the list in the GUI, but we found it.
That's terrible.
Yep. I found a Mac OS X Hints article as I found it, Jeff Gamet was busy digging into his system, and he actually found it on his own. If you look in your home folder and the library folder, if you have created the learn list, it is in the spelling folder. Otherwise, the spelling folder will not exist. And then for me, because my language is set to English, the name of the file is EN. Now, you can open this file in just about any text editor, but be careful. Each word is separated by a delimiter. Now, delimiter is the character between words. This one is one that many text editors cannot see. I opened it in BBEdit, and I was able to see it by going to the text menu, the view menu, I guess, and choosing text display and show hidden characters. Text menu, and then show hidden characters. That let me see the delimiters, and really all I did was wipe out the file because I didn't have anything that I had learned in there prior. But that's where it lives. That's how you edit it. If you don't have BBEdit, if you're not comfortable with the terminal, the only option you really have is erase the entire file, empty the trash, and start from scratch learning new custom spellings. Otherwise, you've got to either use BBEdit, Text Wrangler would be the free alternative, and you can use terminal-based things. I think Emacs and Vi would both get you in there, but those are not for the faint at heart.
Well, Emacs, and actually I saw that when I was looking around at an article suggesting how to mess with this file. And actually, someone I think has also written an Apple script that will manually add things to this file. Because, you know, as a little side thing, hey, if you want a quick and dirty way to add a lot of words to that file, you know, custom words that you don't want it to flag, then normally you can't do that unless you use, you know, as Dave pointed out, some editors that understand these magic characters and you know how to type them in. But somebody's written an Apple script to do that. What else about that? Oh, and now what Dave's speaking about, this is the global, you know, spelling utility within OS X, which is available, I think, as you pointed out, Dave, in Mail and Text Edit and, you know, most Apple applications, and I guess some third party. Mm-hmm. Not everybody uses this spelling database. Like, for example, Microsoft, I guess, does their own thing, and they have their own speller. I think Adobe has their own speller. It's actually kind of sad that everybody has their own dictionary and stuff, where can't you all get together? But the one thing I did notice, that you can also, when you're within a document, like, for example, I'm in Text Edit, if you either go to the Edit menu and say Spelling and Grammar, that will bring up various features of the built-in speller, such as showing the dialogue that lets you do certain things that they've mentioned. You can say Check Document Now. Here's the cool one, you know, Check Spelling While Typing, and that's usually checked. And then Check Grammar with Spelling. So there's... you know, a few things you can access using, well, what else? I guess you can also do it with a contextual menu.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, you get there with the edit menu or the contextual menu over a spelling error. You can get there. That's right. Yeah. So hopefully that helps, Snoop. Again, if you've got to, you can just blow that file away and start from scratch or take your chances editing it. And I guess if that fails, blow it away.
Now, the only thing I guess you and I differed on is that you had claimed, and I believe you, but I thought he was asking about how to unignore things. And what you stated, and you verified, at least on your setup, Dave, was that ignore only lasts for the current application session. Yes?
Yeah. And that's according to Apple as well.
No,
yeah.
I'm with you. Yeah. I thought I had situations where I did that. And when I started the app again, it would not revert to the prior state.
Interesting.
Yeah, and then of course the thing. Now, you know, the one thing, though, I was trying to research this topic, and you know what happened to me again? My library folder disappeared again, because where you're supposed to go is library spelling.
Right.
Or was that the home folder? No, it was the
home
user folder.
Home folder, library, spelling. So users / short username / library / stuff.
I had this happen again, and I had to run the, as you recall, you know, we covered this a while ago, and mm-hmm. I'll link to it again, but I had to run this set file thing. You know, so I could get to it from the go-to folder in the Finder. And so it was there, but it was just invisible in my user view. And I had to run this Apple utility to unset the invisible bit. I don't know who keeps setting it. I'm really wondering.
I think you have gremlins on your computer.
Yeah, it could be a little gremlin. I don't want to reinstall the OS.
That time will come, you know.
Yeah. Oh, what else we got here?
All right. Well, we've answered a bunch of questions. We've got some tips coming up. If you want to contribute to the show, or you want to ask a question, or you simply want to say hi, there's a lot of ways you can do it. So you can email in to feedback@mackeycab.com. That gets to both John and I. And really, I've said this before and I'll say it again. That is absolutely the best email address for anything to do with the show. If you email John or I individually, even if you email us both, it doesn't get into the queue for the show. And it's fine. I mean, if that's what you've done, don't worry about it. But in the future, just try, just use that feedback@mackeycab.com. It makes life a whole lot easier for us.
Yeah. Except for, you know, the groupies, the real, you know, hardcore fans, if you really want to mail us directly.
There you go. That's fine.
Secret stuff you don't want the other person to see.
That's right.
Seriously.
Okay.
Please share. Yeah, it really helps us put the show together if you send to the group email address.
Yeah. So you can Skype to Mac Geek Gab. And again, that account is never available on Skype, but you send voicemail to it and that gets right to us. It actually, we've got a magic little setup. It gets right to us immediately. We don't have to go into Skype to check it anymore. It comes right to that same feedback@MacGeekGab.com email.
Yeah,
box.
I'd prefer call. You know, a lot of people like the phone. I hear the phone's very popular.
Yeah, and how do they dial the phone there, John?
Well, you know, you got these buttons, 1, 2, 3, 206-666-GEEK, which is, Dave, as you know,
4335. And then John has not joined the fray yet, and I can't really blame him. But you can follow me on Twitter.
I get the notifications.
Twitter.com. Well, you get the notifications for people following the Mac Geek Gab thing, which doesn't have any activity on Twitter. But you can follow me at twitter.com/Dave Hamilton. And I'm usually pretty active there. In addition to there, I'll do our tips backwards. A bunch of you had emailed me and a couple had even sent me messages via Twitter asking, you know, I kind of mentioned my backup strategy in a recent show. And a bunch of you said, okay, you sort of glossed over it. Can you write it down somewhere? And I did. I actually posted it to my blog. We'll put a link in the show, and then we reran it over at TMO to expose it to even more of you. So you can look at it at either place. There's actually more comments on the post on my blog than there are on the one on TMO, just because it went up earlier. So make sure you check them both out. So
yeah, that was good. I remember us talking about that, and it was like peeling an onion, because initially it was like, well, I only do this. Well, no, wait, I do this too.
Right. Right.
Backup strategies are Yeah, I mean, sometimes they get kind of complex.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what you're trying to do. But, yeah, I think yours is good because you have no, what do we call it in the computer? Single point of failure.
Never have
a single point of failure. Spread the joy, spread the love.
Right.
Put your backups all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, location, I don't know if you do this. You probably don't get this extreme, but I know a lot of data centers do is data centers will do this is that you don't have all your backup tapes in one location because heaven forbid if, something destroys a physical location. Well,
yep.
Maybe you should spread it around the country or around a physical area. So maybe have one at work, have one at home, or depending on your security policy. But that I think is usually for data that is really critical. You don't want to have the backups all in one physical location.
I agree. And that's actually the reason that I set the time capsule up over at the house, because I figured the data on my work machine here in the office is the critical data. And, the house and the office are separate. There's maybe 100 feet between them. And there's Ethernet cable underground. Chances are if the office torches, the house is going to be all right and vice versa. I mean, it would take a lot to get fire from one to the other. So that was actually part of my thinking of putting that time capsule over there, because now I've got all my data backed up and it's at the house. So if the house gets torched, well, the data is still here at the office in its various capacities. And if the office gets torched, well, it's still on the time capsule over at the house. So.
Nice. So short of a meteor strike or something, I think you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, exactly. And, you can't account for all, what do we call them, acts of God, right? That's what the lawyers like to call them. So I've accounted for some, and I think that's, that's a feather in my cap. Speaking of feathers in one's cap, I'm pretty sure we used the reverb on this particular wish, and it appears as though it's come true, though. I don't have an Apple TV, but Baco does.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Baco in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I was just listening to your latest podcast. I'm sitting here on my walk, actually, as we speak, and I observed something the other night on the Apple TV, when I saw it, it was new with the updates for the Mobile Me, or I don't know how long it's been there, but I thought it was with the Mobile Me. I'm staying pretty recent with those. And it's something that, Dave, you had asked for a long time ago, and it's now when you're browsing the movie store, you have a new wish list option. You can kind of flag these things and come back to them later when you need. All right, that's it. Just a little tip. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much, Baco. That's great to know. Okay, so we do have two more haikus to go through, and these are haikus to finish up the Smile on My Mac contest. And so we'll do one now, and then we've got some cool stuff that has been found that we want to talk about, and then we'll wrap the show up with the other one. Ron Miller wins with Form Meets Function Here, What I Can Think, I Can Mac, Beauty Still Within. I like that. That's nice, Ron. Yeah.
Short and sweet. That just sings to me.
It does. It, and that one sang to everyone. I we'd pass these around here. I'd given them all to Lisa and John, of course, and I looked at them, and Pilot Pete, and every single person that looked at them pulled that one out of the list of however many there were. So that one, very nicely done, Ron. Okay. So we've got some cool stuff to talk about. Can I talk about File Magnet, John?
Yes, of course you can.
Well, thank you. So the iPhone is this little device that you carry with you everywhere. And like an iPod, it's got storage capability. But being an iPhone, you can't access the file system on it. So it means you can't use it like a portable flash drive. Well, File Magnet solves that problem. It's an app that you install on the iPhone from the App Store. And then you also install an app on your Mac. And it's available at magnetismstudios.com/filemagnet. And what it does is over a Wi-Fi network, it allows you to copy files to and from your iPhone. John, you're saying that you think we talked about this already. I think we talked about it.
We touched on it.
We talked about it in prep for last week's show. I'm pretty sure it never actually made it into the show.
Okay.
I think. But if I'm talking about it again, that
if not, it's pretty darn cool, though.
It is. Yeah. And so the cool thing is you can copy files to it and from it from any Mac. You're on a Wi-Fi network and you give it access and there you go. The other thing is you can view a lot of the files that are on it. Excel files. Some of those get a little wacky, but certainly PDFs and Word documents and. They're coming up with a filter that'll let you see any iWork documents, text files, all that stuff. You can just view them right there on the phone. So it in addition to being just a dumb device in that it just ports files around it, it's actually a somewhat smart device that's getting even smarter that lets you see these files. So a very cool thing. It's $4.99 in the App Store. The app for your Mac is free, so you download it for your iPhone. And then you're good to go. So check it out. Now, John, you found something cool. You stumbled onto something cool.
I stumbled on it. So we were talking about the speller and so, you know, I was floating around my different apps trying to, you know, figure out which ones they worked in. And I was in Safari and I just noticed this when I right clicked, or control click, you know, which brings up that thing normally. I saw a little element here, called inspect element, but no, I saw a choice on the menu. Even if you don't highlight something, when I right click, I see inspect element. I'm like, gee, I don't remember seeing that before. So I clicked on it. This is like the king of all web parsing debugging, or it looks to be a very, I won't get too gushy about it, but I'm looking at this and based on what I know about web page construction, this basically shows you every little piece of the web page. It shows you the HTML files. It shows you the CSS files, the cascading style sheets that are used to describe how it's laid out. It shows you the images. And if you click on an image, it'll either show it to you, or if it shows it to you, you can then click further and download it. So this looks to be a, you know, I've heard it said that good artists borrow, great artists steal is one way to, you know, make a really nice page of your own is to steal it. No, I certainly don't recommend that. Be inspired by other people's pages, but it'll show you the JavaScripts. I'm looking at this now and other elements, but it looks like it does a pretty good job of ripping apart a page and showing you what it's made out of. So if you're curious about how to make, a professional looking page or, you know, what makes a page tick, this app looks really cool. Now, you and I, Dave, I seem to always see this, at least on one of my machines here, no matter what I did, if I turned on or turned off the develop menu, which is the menu that, you know, you got to be, well, not careful, but, you know, it's for the heavier geeks out there. But usually you can bring that up if you go to preferences and then in the advanced section, say show develop menu. And you were saying that only when that's on, Dave, do you see that menu. I found different. So I don't know what I did on my system to cause that anomaly. But
you also have the magically disappearing library folder. So we aren't going to use yours as the go-to machine.
Other than that, everything works great. But it's an amazing little tidbit that I had never noticed in my contextual menu before. So
yeah, it lets you walk the DOM, the document object model for how the website's built. And it's cool. It when you brought it up, it reminded me of an application that I have found somewhat invaluable when tweaking websites and just playing with things. And that is CSS Edit from MacRabbit.com. What that lets you do is you can edit HTML and edit a cascading style sheet, and it will render your changes live, real time. As you're editing, your changes affect the page that you're viewing. This, when you first use this, you think, oh, dude, it's perfect. The next time I need to, you know, tweak a website, this is what I'm going to do. Well, that's great, except that you can't develop in Safari. You have to develop and test in Internet Explorer 6. Otherwise, trust me, I know this from experience. If you don't test an IE6 while you're doing this, you will wind up with a page that looks great in Safari and Firefox and totally doesn't render at all in IE6. So, but that said, CSS Edit is a fantastic app and you should check it out. And they didn't pay us to say that. I just say it because it's pretty darn cool, but don't forget to test an IE6. Otherwise, you'll pay a designer a lot of money to fix whatever you broke.
You know, Dave, a little mini rant, though we spoke about this before the show. If you design a website and it doesn't work with certain browsers, that's just really, I mean, I don't know how to say it, lame or just...
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been running into this in several situations. I won't go into great detail, though people that know me will know a few cases where I can go off. But, you know, just test your website. The whole point of the web is that everybody should be able to access the same info in the same way. And to see either browsers or people that develop web apps break that just brings a tear to my eye.
Yep.
It really does.
Yep. I agree. Apple's advice is actually pretty good in that regard. They always tell you, don't test for browser type, test for feature. So if there's some feature that you know, okay, look, Safari doesn't have it, but IE does, don't just say it needs to be IE. Do a JavaScript test to see if that feature is available. And if it is, let your code run, because some other browser might come out that has that feature, and there's no reason to stop it from running whatever your code is. So,
and I think I told you one specific application, though I won't be specific about it, where I was able to trick the application into working by, on the first page of the application, I disabled cascading style sheets. And it revealed a flaw in the coding of the page. I was able to get past that one page and then continue on my merry way through the rest of the site. So, yeah, it's just...
It's crazy.
I thought the day of pages saying I will only work on IE or whatever have passed, but sadly they haven't.
Sadly they haven't. All right. I think it's time to bring the band in. And... you know, we've got one more contest winner to run through here. And this one's a long one, but it's worth it. We'll have some music behind us, and we'll just roll through this. Let me find it here very quickly.
Oh, I think I have it here.
I got it. You want to do it? Take it. Go.
I'm going to go with it.
Okay.
And this is a extended haiku, I would call it. Form meets function.
No, that's you're reading Ron's. Skip what? Down one stanza, and then
read. Sorry, there we go.
Joshua Horn sends this in. Go ahead.
Sorry, thank you, Joshua. Okay, that's right. Okay, back in dark times, computing gave no delight. I was on Windows. A friend saw my plight. He enlightened my poor soul. Get a Mac, he scolds. iMac, Mac Mini. What could all of these names mean? I said, I'll start small. I received my Mac. It was so white and so slick. Mouse, keyboard, and all. Was simple at first, but issues always arise. Who could now guide me? I needed some help. I turned to podcasts for it. Two gabbing Mac geeks. Once I was clueless, computing was not my thing. Then a Mac I bought. Mackie Gab taught me. I'm now a master of Mac, where once I was not.
That's very nicely done. I like it.
And you know, the end of that leads into... Well, we got to hold off a bit, but doesn't it just flow, Dave?
It does. It just rolls. I like it. I like it. I like it. I like it.
But you have a few things to mention before we'll...
We do.
Okay, so iPhone Alley and, of course, the iPhone Alley podcast are created by Michael Johnston, and he's the one that kindly converts this into AAC for your listening and interactive pleasure. CashFly Hosting provides all of the bandwidth for downloading the Mac Geek Gab and getting it to your machine. Lickety-split. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 and A2 desktop speakers and everything else from Audio Engine, especially with your MGGTEN 10% off Audio Engine products coupon this month and next month. BB Edit from Barebone Software. Page Sender and Haikus from Smile on my Mac. Conference Recorder from Ecamm. And of course, a free audiobook from Audible. Mac Geek Gab. We have a link at MacGeekGab.com, but you can go there, audiblepodcast.com/MacGeekGab. And then, of course, Harman-eTravel, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. And we love iTunes comments. So if you've got a spare moment, head over to iTunes, leave a comment. We've got a link in the show notes to get you right there. And I think... we have anything else, John, or are we out of here?
We still whooping Adam on the comments.
Oh, my God.
Sorry.
Oh, my God.
Hi, Adam. He's going to get me at a, oh, that's right.
Portable Media, New Media Expo, 2 weeks from Wednesday.
He's going to get me then, I'm sure.
John and I will be there flying out 2 weeks from Wednesday. We'll be there Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
And we may podcast.
Yeah, we should podcast. Podcast we shall, unless...
Well, you know, I'm just going to reiterate, but here, the last verse, Mackie Gab taught me, I'm now a master of Mac, where once I was not, I shall not get caught. Modified haiku.
Made up.